I think you are probably in the same position that I am in which have lots of times in running into people in our community and studying with folks and having conversations that we hear a lot of folks talking about the desire to know what God is doing in their lives. And, of course, in many of the religious world and in greater part, even in our fellowship, I run into a lot of Christians who are talking about God's specific plan for their life or how they felt like God has led them to do this or that, or that maybe it was meant to be God's will when something happened in their life, and even something really bad happens, and well, I suppose this is what God wanted to happen to me, and just lots of statements like that. Sometimes, of course, people who are very secular will say things like, well, it was just fate. I always think about the Greek, there was a Greek god who was fate, you know, so like that sort of thing. And then there's still others, of course, who would say things like, well, I really felt the Spirit leading me to do this or that, or I felt like God was telling me this or that, or I felt that He was giving me a message by these events in my life. And all of those things give us the picture and the feeling that, you know, that really is a desire in our life. Those of us who preach have oftentimes ask God to help us when it comes to what would you like me to do next? And we are frustrated sometimes by thinking, I wish He'd just give me a nice neon sign. I'm driving down the road and the neon says, Barry, it's time to move. Something like that. And that desire, I think, permeates all of us. Just give me a straight answer. I would love to know. We pray about it, which is good. We ask God to help us in the decision, which is great. We ask for wisdom. James chapter 1 commands us to do so and says He will give us wisdom abundantly and will not upbraid. These are all things that are certainly biblical, but then there is this tendency sometimes to read the signs, so to speak, to try to figure out the events and come up with a message that God must be giving me at this time. And if you've had many conversations with people who are looking for those things, you will note that they find them a lot. And you will also note that they find them to be wrong a lot of times too. And they get desperately disappointed or just figure out, well, doesn't seem to change their mind that God's sending messages. It's like a flip of the coin, whether it was a good one or a bad one. But that's the way it goes. So, you know, when I hear people say things like that, I often just think in terms of, how do you know? How do you really know that that was the message? If you're like me, and I would imagine my brain isn't much different than yours in some ways. Well, in some ways it really is. But but in regard to a billion things go through your mind all the time. You think, well, maybe this, maybe this. Well, hey, boy, you know, that's a pretty good idea. And sometimes later on you don't know. You know, I think about Jacob. Joseph was dead in Jacob's mind. There was no question in his mind. Joseph was dead. For 23 years, Joseph was dead in Jacob's mind. And Joseph was wrong. I mean, Jacob was wrong. It didn't matter how strong his feelings were. It didn't matter how sure he was that Joseph was dead. Joseph wasn't dead. So our feelings have lots and lots of mistakes to them. Our minds are only ways in which we process events and facts and try to come to conclusions, but the conclusions are not always right. You know, none of us even know what's going on 50 yards from here right now. We have no idea what's even outside these walls right now. What could be happening? There could be a SWAT unit surrounding this building right now, thinking that we're smoking crack. And we wouldn't know it until the doors came flying in. We don't know things. And yet, somehow, some way, folks get in their minds that they can determine what's happening in the spiritual world around us. So the question I want to explore with you this morning is, what does the Bible really say about that? What can we find in Scripture? The first place I would like us to go to is the book of Job. And we're just going to hit some passages fairly quickly in the book of Job and give you an idea of Job's struggle with these things. First, let's just start right after the trial hits Job and after his Satan has now struck his body. And in the third chapter of Job, we see down in verse 12, 11 and 12, Job says, "Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse?" Notice the question of why. When we're in a trial, how many of us ask the question of why? Yes, especially really bad trials. We're not talking about the trial where your air conditioner breaks. We're talking about those trials where you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, where you have no idea what the end result is. One of the things that Job teaches us, the book of Job teaches us over and again, is that these trials will be the lot of all of us at some point or another if we live long enough. We will deal with some severe trials, not light trials. You know, in the book of Job, he makes a differentiation between the trials of just the challenges of everyday life and the trial where you lose your spouse or your child dies or sometimes even worse things can happen than death that you are having to struggle with for long periods of time. A husband leaves you and runs off with somebody else. A wife does a similar thing, and the pain and agony that you go through year after year after year, and you wonder, where's the light at the end of the tunnel? These are the kinds of things that Job deals with. He cannot see any way, shape, or form that this is going to turn out right, so he says, "I don't get it, God. Why didn't I just die? Why? What is the point of letting me live to this particular time? And it just seems like that was a waste of my life. Why?" And then later in chapter 3 in verse 20, "Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death but it comes not, and dig for it more than hidden treasures?" Well, why in the world, God, would you not just let me die right now? Doesn't that make sense to you? It makes absolute sense to me. The misery is in. When you go over and read chapter 29 and 30 of this book, you see the misery Job is in. He says, "My bones are sticking out." He says, "Servants and people of the town who sleep under bushes in the desert, who my dog wouldn't even want to be around, come and spit on me. Why don't you let me die? What is the point of such an existence?" We see that in our country all the time. Well, got to the point where I have a right to kill myself if I want to. I have a right to have a doctor, you know, put me out of my misery, or things like this. And that's Job. Job's not suicidal, but he desires death, and he can't figure out why God will not let that happen to him. And so the why issue comes up. Look in chapter 7 of Job, and verse 19 through 21. Chapter 7, verse 19. He says, "How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? And now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be." So again, you see all the why questions? "I don't get it," he says. You won't even let me swallow my spit without pain. In other passages, he says, when I finally get some sleep, you terrify me with nightmares. Why would you do that to me? I have apologized. I've asked for forgiveness. Whatever sin it is, I don't know. But please, why are you doing this? You see the feeling? Sure, that would be a part of all of us. I just don't get it. Why would this happen to me? And you notice that Job begins to grasp for answers. He imagines that God is this way or that way. Why wouldn't he do this? God, and he's pretty harsh terms at times. Just guessing and assuming that the cause is really God and that God is doing this to him. Actuality, of course, all of us are behind the scene. We're looking in and going, Job, it's not God. Satan's been doing it. Yeah, God allowed it, but Satan's doing this, and there's really a great purpose to it. And Job's sitting there going, he's sitting in the middle of it. He can't figure it out. Well, here's the most righteous man in the world at the time, and God's not giving him any answers. Don't you see how contradictory that is to the way people are doing today with their looking for messages and being able to interpret what God's actually doing in this particular situation? Look in chapter 13 of Job and verse 20. Job 13. Job 13, verse 20. He begins now, Job begins to make deals with God. He says, only grant me two things, then I will not hide myself from your face. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not dread of you terrify me. Then call, and I will answer, or let me speak, and you reply to me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? I really love this part because you can just see the depth of frustration that Job gets to. He says, okay, God, look, I don't get it. Why don't we just do this? You remove your hand from me, just let off for a second. Just give me a little break here from the agony I'm in and let's have a conversation. I mean, I'm a reasonable man. Just have a conversation with me and you tell me what the problem is and I'll respond, or I can ask you questions and you can respond and we can just sit down man to man and have a little conversation about this. I think we can solve the problem. That's pretty reasonable. And God is silent. God doesn't say a word. And the frustration gets deeper and deeper and deeper because he can't find an answer. Again, how contradictory to what is happening in our society around us. Everybody seems to say they have a right to know and that they have some answers and that God is giving them answers. We had one of the saddest situations in Nashville. It was a lady who was a member of a Church of Christ that was a little more loose than what I would have gone along with, but still, sweet lady, and she was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, and so you know she had two young children. She's only in her mid 30s or so, and it was just awful, and she. She started a kind of a blog on Facebook to talk about her experiences and to talk about what she was going through. And in the course of, I suppose, maybe up to 2 years that she suffered before she died, she constantly was informing everybody of messages and dreams and various leadings that God was giving her concerning her condition. Even to the point that in one dream she let everyone know that God had assured her that she was not only going to get well, but that she was going to have another child. And so she was quite detailed about how this was going to progress and confident that God had given her these messages. And this just went on and on. And Teresa and I are just like, oh my goodness, this poor girl. Not only is she believing that the things that are going on in her mind are messages from God, but she's She's expressing a false hope here, very possibly, and then not only that, she's leading others to think in this way, and she's been misled. That's just not the way that this works. And this is what you see in Job's situation. Job just gets to the point where now he's dictating to God the way things ought to be. And this is typical for us when we're going through pain, whether emotional or physical pain. That is a very typical thing to say, why, God, I'm sure this is not what your will is. And so then we begin to imagine what God's will really would be and what really ought to happen, and things are very strong in our minds, and we begin to draw conclusions that simply aren't there. Okay, so what happens at the book, end of the book of Job when God finally speaks? You get to chapter 38 and you go, okay, finally God's going to talk. Finally God's going to give some answers to this whole thing. And let's just notice the first seven verses of Job chapter 38 when God finally speaks to Job. 38:1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it? Or what were its base, on what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" In our language, okay, smarty pants, you know, you've been the one smarting off and talking about how much you knew and why things ought to be and how I ought to have a conversation with you and all of that. All right. Get your big boy pants on and let's have a conversation. Where were you when I made everything? Who are you to start telling me how things ought to be? And of course, God goes on in chapter 38, 39, 40, and 41, just blistering him with questions. And Job gets to the end, he says, "Shut my mouth. I have just spoken without knowledge, out of ignorance, the whole thing." All of the ideas and feelings, I mean, just check it out. You have chapter 3 through chapter 30, 31 of yakking by friends who haven't got the slightest idea what's going on. And Job, who doesn't have the slightest idea who's going on, look at all the territory God spent. If you wrote the book of Job, would you have put chapter 3 through chapter 37 there? We'd just go, no, here's how I'd have done that. I'd have written first two chapters, here's the trial. Chapter 3, here's the frustration. Chapter 4, here's God's ending. You know, I mean, really. We all, even as we're reading through all those debates, going, "Ha, you're wearing me out. Zophar, would you please shut up? Bildad, what is the matter with you? Oh, Eliphaz. Most frustrating guys ever." And then Job starts telling God, "Come on, let's have a conversation. I'll take you on. Hey, I'm going to say some things you won't be able to answer." Oh, my. And God, I know what you're going to do. Once I lay out the cause, God's going to go, "Huh." Stroke his long beard and say, "Job, I guess I really messed up here. Man, I'm sorry. I'm going to fix that right away." That seems to be the whole thing. You get to the end, all that yakking, and God comes along and He asks questions for four chapters. Questions that you and I today in our brilliant scientific world still cannot answer. And in all of it, did He ever answer any of Job's questions? No. He never answered any of them. And I want to suggest to you that's the best thing He ever did, is to not answer the questions. Let's see why. Take a look over in the book of Ecclesiastes now. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And let's notice the first 11 verses there. I would ask you a trivia question and say, who sang this back in the 60s? But I don't want to date myself. I know Ross would know. He'd probably listen to the birds a lot, you know. Chapter 3. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh, and a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away. A time to tear, and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity into man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful. They do good as long as they live, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Why did the inspired preacher give us these 14 opposites of life? You know, when you and I look at those opposites, if you had control, which ones would you cause to happen? I like the time to be born, not the time to die. I like the time to plant, not necessarily the time to pluck up what's planted. I like the time to heal, not the time to kill. I like the time to build up, not the time to break down. On and on. I like the time of love. I don't like the time of hate. I like the time of peace, not the time of war. What is everyone trying to do? Trying to manipulate life so that the good part happens and the bad part doesn't. How do we do with that? Doesn't work, does it? And that's the point of the text. God says, you don't have control. Here's what happens in life, and you can stand on your head and turn blue. You're not going to change it. That's just the way it is. These things are going to happen. We do everything we can to not have a time of war, and we have a time of war. You know, all you got to do is just go over and have a nice conversation with the terrorists, and they'll go, "Oh, I'm sorry. I just can't believe I just was thinking you guys were bad guys. Sorry, we'll never do that again." Yeah, that worked with Hitler, didn't it? Can't do it. We can't stop it. It's just the way it is. It's these times that come up. And that's why he says there in at the middle of verse 11, he said, put eternity in man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Why has he done things this way? So you can't find out. What is everybody doing in our religious world around us? They keep thinking they can find out. They can keep thinking that they can just go and if they pray enough, God's going to give them some little leading. One of our members was talking to a friend of hers recently, and the friend said, "You know what I do? I really look for God's leading, so I go to the mall, and if there's something on sale, I know God's led me to buy it." She was not kidding. She was dead serious. Like, really? That's the true message, for sure. And so, it's just this kind of thing. And God says, I've done these things so you can't find out. I don't want you to find out. Why is that better? Why is that better? Because it forces me to trust the one who knows? God knows. And when I can just relax, don't you love His end result there in verse 12? I perceived. Here's the conclusion. I perceive then that there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. And also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gifts to man. So what do? I quit trying to figure out what's going to happen tomorrow and worrying about it and get flustered and stuff, and enjoy the gifts God has given me today and do good. Do good in my life. Look at chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes and verse 13 and 14. What a beautiful answer he gives here to this. 7:13, consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? That's an excellent conclusion from what those contrasts were back in chapter 3. Who can make straight what he's made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Oh, I just love that. That is fantastic. I always got a kick of the Back to the Future movies. You know, it's just kind of, oh, neat, man. If something's going wrong, go back to the future, so to speak, and fix it so that it all works out okay. If we could control our lives, like I'm supposed to take a flight back to Nashville on Saturday. If I were able to get this leading that flight 6294 Southwest flight at 5 p.m. is going to crash in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm not getting on that thing. There you go. I've got control over my life. And God says, I don't want you having control of your life. So I have all these things that happen in life. Some days are going to be prosperity and you can be joyful. Some days are going to be adversity and you're going to consider. One happens as well as the other so that you can't find out what's going to happen after you. Oh, good. What a bummer to know what's going to happen after me. I can now just trust God. I can know that He's the one in control. I can know that no matter what the kind of day it is and what kind of future it is, God is going to be there to provide for me. Do I have to be wise? Certainly. Do I have to prepare for the future as best I can? Of course. Proverbs chapter 6 says, go to the ant, sluggard. Don't sit back on your haunches and not do something. Do something. Get prepared. Ecclesiastes will say the same thing in chapter 11. It looks like things aren't going to look good, go out and sow your seed. Cast your bread upon the waters. He's not saying don't do anything, but he's saying you put your confidence in God. Do we save for retirement? Of course we do. But where's our confidence? Not in our retirement, in God. I mean, I look at it and I go, wait, the way the economy goes up and down, fat chance. I keep telling my boys every time they call me up and say, Dad, I don't have enough money for books. I said, your mom and dad one day are going to be living in a trailer park underneath the airport if you don't quit taking our money. But where's our confidence? It's not in that. You do what you can do. God will bless. God will take care. God will get us through whatever it is. Tell me that's not a whole lot better than knowing. Tell me that's not a whole lot better than fretting every day and trying to figure out the signs and trying to figure out, was that a leading God gave me? Was that a message He had for me? Oh my. It's so much better. Look at chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes. Beginning at verse 16. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 16. He said, when I applied my heart to know wisdom, to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Look at that. He tells us straight out. He says, you know, I've tried to figure it all out. I can't. Man can't find it out. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. That's pretty plain. Just stop. Rely on God. Quit trying to figure everything out that you don't know. It's beyond your knowledge. Unfortunate chapter division here, by the way. Chapter 9:1. But all this I laid into heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good is, so is the sinner. And he who swears is he who shuns an oath. This is an evil that all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also the hearts of the children of men are full of evil and madness in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. What's the problem, God says? Here's the preacher explaining, since we can't find it out, since you can look through things and you look at all the events of life, and it doesn't matter whether a person is a righteous person or not a righteous person, whoever, the same event happens to everybody. And so you can't look at anything and go, ah, here's what God's doing. You can't determine it by the events of life. And thus, even the evil people see that the same bad events happens to all, and it just causes them to be more evil because they seem to get away with it. I mean, all of us have been there where we did something wrong, and we think, oh, hope nobody catches me. Hope nobody... All of a sudden, a month goes by, nobody caught me. Oh, cool. 2 months go by, nobody caught me. 6 months go by, nobody found out. A year goes by, nobody found out. Wow, I can get away with evil. Obviously, a righteous person is not going to think that way, but that's the way the evil think, and that's what he's saying in the text. You can't know those things. It's impossible. We cannot look and make determinations as to what God is doing by simply just looking at the events of life. It doesn't always play out that way. Now, so what's the conclusion? Typical for people today, and especially religious people, to ascribe everything that happens to God. That's what happened in the book of Job. Everything that's happening is God. I want to suggest to you 5 different reasons something happens. Okay? 5 different reasons something happens that the Bible tells us about this. And this, I hope, will be helpful to you, especially in discussing these issues with people in the religious world. The first thing is, Satan did it. That's one of the last ones that people ever think of. You know, they're a terrible accident and somebody dies and somebody says, well, I guess it was just God's will, and God will probably work this out for good, and things like this, etc., etc. Maybe Satan did that. Maybe it's part of the evil of what Satan did. After all, when you look at Job chapter 1, how many things did Satan do? Satan brought a whirlwind, killed the children. Satan brought the Sabaeans in, the destroyed, and took away all the animals and killed the servants. Satan did cause the illness to Job. Satan did all of those things. God didn't do those things. I always think, wow. Look at what Satan can do. Look at where God has given him control of many, many things. Even some of the acts of nature were things that Satan had done. In Daniel chapter 10, do you remember what takes place in Daniel 10 when Daniel is asking for the answer to the vision that God had given? And for 3 weeks he prays that God will send an angel to answer or send some answer to the vision. And in the 10th chapter, finally the angel comes. And when the angel explains what has been taking place for the last 3 weeks,
The angel says this right there in the middle of verse 12 of Daniel 10. He says, "Fear not, Daniel, from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia, and came to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for days yet to come." And then when he gets done all of that and gives Daniel the answer, he gets down to verse 20. He says, "Then he said, 'Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and then I go out, and behold, the prince of Greece will come.'"
Oh boy, look at that. It's like God just gave you one of those little peepholes that you look through and you go, "What's going on that other side there?" God gives a little peephole into the spiritual arena. Angels battling, powerful angels who are controlling countries and moving countries to wars and battles and takeovers and things like this. You go, "What? Who's doing it?" There's some spiritual forces of wickedness, as Paul said in Ephesians 6:12. We don't battle against flesh and blood. We battle against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's who we're battling against, and that's what's going on. Yes, Satan is at work very strongly. And so that's one reason things can be happening around us. Another is God did it. You know, Joseph was able to make that particular conclusion as he looked back over the things that had happened. And maybe sometimes we can do the same on look back and go, "Wow, you know, I couldn't figure out what was going on there. Couldn't figure out how this would be, but I can see how God brought me through those things." In Genesis 45 and verse 5. Joseph says, "And now be not distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors." In fact, that little incident saved thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of lives all over that known world, just because of an evil that the brothers had done, but God used the evil to bring about the salvation of His family. So God can do things. God uses it. We talk about providence. In Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5 through 7, God said He would use the Assyrian Empire to come and punish the nation of Israel. He says, even though He does not mean to do so, yet I'm going to use Him as a paddle to whip and punish my people for what they have done. Alright? So, God did it. Third, cause and effect. Cause and effect affect us all the time. Proverbs. What's Proverbs? Proverbs is all about cause and effect. Proverbs 17:13, "Do not love sleep, or you will become poor. Open your eyes, and you will be satisfied with food." One of the great things, one of the great conversations that we should have nearly on a daily basis with our children is two paths. It's two choices. There's the narrow path that leads to life. There's the broad way that leads to destruction. And that plays itself out over and over again in the events of this life. You make this choice, here's generally what's going to happen. You make this choice, here's generally what's going to happen. You make a good choice, generally you're going to have some good consequences that come from it. You make a bad choice, bad consequences are going to come. That's just the way life is. So choose wisely. And then, of course, there's everybody else who's making choices around us. And their choices affect us. And so cause and effect. I may make good choices, somebody around me makes bad choices, and when they make bad choices, I get affected. And so things happen because of choices that are made. Sometimes even the most minor decisions, you notice that, those of you who are older, all of us, the most minor decisions we made in our lives, we look back and we didn't even give 2 seconds thought to that decision. And we look back and go, "Wow, did that lead down an interesting path. Maybe a tough path. But you know what? Just because it was a tough path didn't make it a wrong path. Righteous choices end up in a tough path. And God is not interested in taking away all of our tough paths because we learn from them. You know, Tom Brokaw wrote about the greatest generation. But what have made the greatest generation a great generation? Hardship. Sacrifice. What made you and gave you the character you have today? Hardship and sacrifice. Difficulties, trials that you had to work out on your own. And what do we do as parents? Oh, let's make sure our children don't ever have any bad consequences, and let's just take care of everything and come to their help, and if they do something wrong, we'll go chew the teacher out, and we'll, you know, all this kind of stuff. Oh, what damage we do. Kid, it was your choice. You made a dumb choice. Deal with it. I had to. It ain't the end of the world. It'll make you a better man. It'll make you a better woman. Learn hardship. I watch marriages all the time where she was a princess growing up. And everything was always taken care of. And Daddy called her her little princess. His little princess, and took care of her all the time. Everything. And now she gets married. And why aren't you treating me like the princess? Why aren't you taking care of me like Daddy did? Girl, you ain't living Cinderella. You know, Cinderella was a bad movie. You know why? Because here's a girl who was mopping and cleaning and darning socks and all these things, and she finally found her Prince Charming, and the movie ends as they go off in the sunset, and they don't tell the end of it that the next day she was washing, cleaning, and darning and cleaning socks and doing all the things and having babies and having diapers. Yes. We don't escape hardship. And it makes us a better people. Cause and effect. Always happen. Now here's one, the fourth one. Here's one that I'll tell you what, I have had some of the most religious people in denominations that you could imagine just have a fit about this can't be. This just can't be. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11 and 12. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11 and 12. Again I saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, like birds that are caught in a snare. So the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Why do things happen? Time and chance. You just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the right time, or whatever. Time and chance happens to all. And it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're strong. It doesn't matter if you're weak. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you're righteous or unrighteous. Time and chance happens to all. And boy, I'll tell you what, that's one of those things. Because the religious world has been taught the Calvinistic doctrine that God controls everything that happens in life. You know, Calvin taught that even the drop of rain that might hit you in the eye, God guided that rain to hit you in the eye. And this is the way He controls. It's the absolute sovereignty of God, and there's just no free will or choice or anything like that. So God wanted all this evil to happen. So God's making all this evil happen. This is the conclusions that are drawn. No. Time and chance happens to all. Ecclesiastes 1:15. There's so many crooked things you can't number them. There's so many crooked things that you can't, and you can't straighten them. What's going on? God made it so that you can't find out what's happening after you. After all, are we in heaven yet? Are we in the wilderness? We're going to the promised land. We're not in heaven yet, and what do we try to do? We try to act like it ought to be heaven right now. No, this is the wilderness. We're going through the promised land. We're eating the manna. You know, it's tough. It's difficult. We always ridicule Israel.
Oh, go into the wilderness. This is a bummer. We're having to walk, you know, and we have to eat this manna for 40 years, and it's tough, and we got to live out here in the desert, and we got to look for water and all this kind of stuff, and on top of it all, we're going to the promised land. Bummer. Why else did Paul say in Philippians chapter 2? Don't grumble. Don't grumble. Oh boy, hit me in the head with that command. That one is a killer, isn't it? Why are you grumbling? You're going to heaven. You're going to heaven. We're on our way to the glory of being with the Lord and living with in His house as a bride to the most wonderful Creator that ever could be, and we're grumbling? That does not make any sense whatsoever, and yet we do it. Time and chance happens to all. The fifth reason things happen. And boy, don't we love this. God answers prayer. Of course, God answers prayer. And we could fill passages with that. James 5, verse 14 through 18. He said, what did Elijah do? Elijah prayed it wouldn't rain. Elijah prayed again and it did rain. He says, and I love the statement. He says, you are like him. Don't look at Elijah and say, oh, you know, Elijah. You know, he says, no. You're of like manner of him. You're just flesh and blood just like he was. And he prayed and God answered. And you can pray and God will answer. 1 John talks about it in chapter 5, verse 14, about how God will answer prayer over and again. The command is for us to pray. You have a Father, ask and you shall receive, knock and it shall be opened to you. If you as a father know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Heavenly Father give good gifts to you? On and on and on. We could talk about that. Philippians chapter 4. Love, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, in prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. God answers prayer. And we need to rely on that. But I'll tell you what. How about this? On the day of judgment, we get to heaven, sit down and have a conversation with God. Just love it. You know, we think right now we'd have a lot of questions, don't we? We think right now, oh yeah, I'm gonna spend up the first 10,000 years asking him questions. He'd probably just fill our heads with all the answers. But so we say, you know, Lord, remember that time I was going through a really tough time and I prayed, and it happened. And I just remember that so much. It was just so great. I prayed and it happened just like I asked. And I just kind of want to know, how did you do that? What was the inner workings? What was behind the scenes that made that happen? Now I know I'm speaking out in the things that I don't know for sure. I'm going to be a little bit like Job here. But I can imagine this. God saying, well, actually, you know, what you prayed for, I figured it. I knew it was just going to happen anyway, so I didn't have to intervene. It just happened. Time and chance, it worked itself out. I go, really? You mean I prayed and it was going to happen anyways? Yeah, one of those things. That didn't always happen, but sometimes that's the way it works. Or maybe he said, you know, you prayed about that. I heard your prayer, just like I hear all of your prayers. But Sally over there was praying also. And she was praying that it would work out this way. And I thought that her way was right. So I answered her prayer in the positive, not really yours. But it worked out for your good. And that's what I did. Really? Didn't think about somebody else praying and it affecting the way I was doing this. Or maybe he says, good thing you prayed. The way it was going was not going to be good. I'm glad you prayed. Because I answered your prayer. And I saved you and your family from some terrible devastations. And some terrible things that would have worked poorly spiritually for all of you. And so I answered your prayer in this way. Wow. Something else. see the point? God is so great that He can use all kinds of things. And we know that about Him. Who would have believed He would have used a traitor to facilitate the crucifixion and the salvation of the world? That doesn't make any sense. And yet He used it. He didn't make Judas do what he did, but He used Judas evil. He is so great, He can use even evil things in order to bring about our good. And so, what is our good? All things work together for them that love the Lord, for them who serve Him and are called according to His purpose. Not that God just says, okay, every terrible thing that happens, I cause that. You know, no, the idea is He's working to what? Our good doesn't mean, oh, our comfort. That's not what He means. Our good is our ultimate salvation, is bringing us to maturity, is bringing us to where He wants us to be. I'll conclude with one verse. We'll just close on this. 1 Thessalonians. This kind of thing is said a number of times at the end of epistles. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 23. Paul says, "Now may the God of peace Himself sanctify you completely, and may your whole spirit and soul and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ." Watch this. "He who calls you is faithful. He will surely do it." Wow. You want to get there? He's going to get you there. That's that. He promised. He's faithful, and He will surely do it. Appreciate our time together, and we will close, I imagine, with a prayer or something. Ross, or what?